Greetings, this is Kevin on 8 Eagles Strong Voice, and this is a special broadcast of Radio Free Canada, Sunday, October 5th, 2025. Today, the historic judgment and sentencing of the International Common Law Court of Justice in the case involving so-called Pope Leo, Robert Prevost, Donald Trump, and 11 other felons who have now been convicted of participating in the Ninth Circle sacrificial cult. Today, we're going to read the judgment and sentence and how we're going about enforcing this, because we're fed up and done with relying on the existing institutions to in any way protect our children from these heinous criminals in power. We are going to do the enforcement. We have deputized police all over the world who are willing to assist us. We'll make the arrests. We'll seize the property and assets of the criminal institutions, the Catholic, Anglican, the United Churches, the Crown of England, various governments, and corporations. That'll be described today. This is the judgment and sentence. You can see it posted online in murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates in the matter of the People versus Robert Prevost and all. On the chief indictment and charge of complicity in crimes against humanity, murder, and participating in the trafficking and ritual rape, torture, and murder of children, issued today, October 5th, 2025, against these defendants: Robert Prevost, so-called Pope Leo XIV, Mark Rutte, Secretary General of NATO, Charles and Andrew Windsor, of the so-called British royal family, Donald Trump, President of the United States, Keith Schiller, his former assistant, Albert Bourla, CEO of Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, Justin Welby, former Archbishop of Canterbury, Fred Hiltz, former Anglican Primate of Canada, Gary Patterson, former moderator of the United Church of Canada, and these three Catholic cardinals, Pietro Parolin, Timothy Dolan, and Reinhard Marx. Here's the background and evidence. 1 month ago, on September 8, 2025, the Criminal Trial Division of the International Common Law Court of Justice convened its proceedings against the defendants by issuing summonses to appear to answer the charges made against them by the court's prosecutor. None of the summoned defendants contested or denied those charges. Accordingly, the court prosecutor commenced his case against them. 2. The prosecution began by describing the lawful basis of the proceedings as a tribunal of conscience under international law. The absence of any other judicial body willing to try the case, the command responsibility of the defendants for the heinous crimes, and their particular culpability because of their association with already convicted criminal organizations, and the defendant's tacit admission of pro-confesso guilt by their refusal to plea. 3. Over the next 3 weeks, the prosecution presented to the court detailed evidence proving the guilt of the defendants, including with live eyewitness testimonies, legal affidavits, coroner's reports, forensic artifacts, extensive documentation, video and photographic evidence, and church, government, and corporate records and correspondence. 4. During the first week of the trial proceedings, the court received back-channel communications from two of the defendants requesting amnesty from prosecution in exchange for their testimonies. The defendants in question were Keith Schiller, former bodyguard to Donald Trump, and Gary Patterson, former moderator to the United Church of Canada. According to the prosecution, both Schiller and Patterson, like all the defendants, are confirmed participants in Ninth Circle cult ceremonies and the related snuff films, and thereby are directly implicated in the ritual rape, murder, and cannibalizing of children. The court therefore denied Schiller's and Patterson's request for amnesty and ordered them to enter a plea. Like the other defendants, neither Schiller nor Patterson did so, affirming their pro-confesso guilt under law. However, both Schiller and Patterson were enjoined by the court to divulge their knowledge of the charges against them and the other defendants, which they did, without recourse to legal counsel. 5. During the trial's third week, the court received remarkable new evidence from sources within the Church of Rome in America. This evidence revealed the involvement of Donald Trump, Pope Robert Prevost, and Cardinal Timothy Dolan as his church associates in the murders of Charlie Kirk, Mormon church leader Russell Nelson, Virginia Guffer, Deutsche Bank officers Valentin Brokschmidt and Thomas Bowers, and a Catholic cleric in Buffalo, New York, Joe Moreno. This evidence sheds more light on the extent of the Ninth Circle cult's operations in America and their close association with the Mormon and Vatican assassination agencies, known respectively as the Day Knights and Santa Alianza. And a note about the clergy within America who assisted Timothy Dolan in killing these individuals, along with the agents of Donald Trump. These other Catholic clergy complicit in the murder, especially of Reverend Joe Moreno in Buffalo, include Bishop Richard Malone and Edward Gross, Vicar David Lipuma, Deacon Paul Weisenberger, Priest Joseph Gatto and Arthur Smith, and a church informer, or rather church enforcer, named Francis Mazur. As secondary co-conspirators, these men will be prosecuted in an upcoming case of the court. Point six. During the same week, the prosecution received confirmation of an extensive child trafficking and killing network spanning the Canadian-American border across Lake Erie. A child trafficking pipeline that services Ninth Circle covens in southern Canada runs from Cleveland and Buffalo to Brantford, London, Hamilton, and Toronto, Ontario. Five of the defendants named in the indictment are implicated in this network. King Charles Windsor and his brother Andrew Windsor, Anglican Archbishops Justin Welby and Fred Hiltz, and former United Church moderator Gary Patterson. Point seven. Evidence concerning the guilt of the defendants, NATO Chief Mark Rutte, Vatican Cardinals Pietro Parolin and Reinhard Marx, and Pfizer CEO Alfred Borla, was provided to the prosecutor by Interpol, Ninth Circle, and corporate sources in New York and Europe. At the behest of the Chinese government, with whom he is intimately connected, Cardinal Pietro Parolin attempted to manipulate Mark Rutte as head of NATO using photographic evidence from Ninth Circle rituals in which Rutte participated. A similar blackmailing was employed successfully against another Ninth Circle participant, Albert Borla, by Cardinals Parolin and Marx in their capacity as Ninth Circle conveners in order to facilitate the takeover of Pfizer by the Vatican Bank. Regardless of Rutte's response to this latest Vatican blackmail, the effect has been to destabilize NATO on the eve of a possible confrontation with Russia, which is likely China's game plan. But it has also made new schisms appear within the Ninth Circle and has encouraged more insiders to come forward. Point eight. In terms of these bigger geopolitical forces, it is clear from the evidence that the recent murder of Charlie Kirk in Utah and the Mormon leader Russell Nelson by Santa Alianza and Day Knight agents is connected to the effort by the Vatican Bank to channel the vast financial assets of the Mormon Church towards China and the BRIC Alliance, with whom the Vatican Bank is partnered. As part of the Mormon Old Guard, Russell Nelson resisted this move and tried to prevent the amalgamation of Vatican assets with those of his own Mormon Church. Charlie Kirk was privy to this conflict, and he was sympathetic to Nelson's position, but as one who was also aware of Donald Trump's role in the murder of Virginia Gouffier, Brokschmidt, and the others we've mentioned, Charlie Kirk was a double liability for both Trump and the Vatican, particularly for Pope Leo, Robert Prevost, who, along with Pietro Parolin, has worked for years to strengthen the ties between the Vatican Bank and Chinese investments all over the world. Point nine. The prosecution submitted to the court a huge archive of evidence pertaining to Ninth Circle ceremonies, including eyewitness accounts, coroner's reports, videos, and 983 pages of documents. This material includes hitherto undisclosed evidence from Vatican Library archives that recount all of the Ninth Circle rituals and the names of their participants that have been held in Rome since December 1869. This evidence chronicles other cults associated with the Ninth Circle in Europe, North America, Australia, and Asia. A Catholic necrophilia cult was discovered by Georgina Cameron, one of our ITCCS field operatives, in Wollongong, Australia, during the summer of 2022. This discovery cost Georgina Cameron her life, but not before she documented how Bishop Brian Mascord of Lumen Christi Catholic Church in Wollongong presides over this cult's ritual rape and evisceration of children. Mascord is assisted in these crimes by Professor Ian Benson of Notre Dame University in Sydney, Australia, and Catholic participants from Melbourne, Shanghai, Seattle, and Vancouver, Canada. This evidence will be included in future sessions of the court. It can also be looked at on murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates, the posting from December 2024. Point 10. In the course of this trial, the court has established the strong ties between the Ninth Circle and the military corporate agencies responsible for developing microchip bioweaponry. Three separate eyewitnesses who survived the Ninth Circle's rituals have described to the court the routine presence of medical researchers at these cult ceremonies, the warehousing of children for drug testing, microimplantation experiments, and blood extraction, and military-run pain threshold experiments performed on children as part of the ritual torture and sacrifice. Pfizer Pharmaceuticals and its CEO Albert Bourla are especially implicated in these atrocities and experiments, as are other drug companies tied to Vatican money like GlaxoSmithKline, Novartis, Bayer, Moderna, and Eli Lilly. The mind control methods and technologies now being deployed against the general population were developed, tested, and refined within the Ninth Circle networks at the cost of untold numbers of children's lives. And for further background on this case, simply go to murderbydecree.com, the last four or five postings at ITCCS updates. And a final note, the personal guilt of the defendants for their involvement in Ninth Circle atrocities has been established by the prosecution without ever being contested or denied by the defendants or by any contrary evidence or information. The details of the defendants' guilt are elaborated in the judgment and sentence against them, based on the exhaustive evidence held in the files and archives of the court. Now, this evidence is held in trust by the court and will be made public in increments so as not to jeopardize either future litigation or the safety or identity of eyewitnesses. Applications to review this evidence can be made to and will be considered by the court by writing to the court at itccsoffice@protonmail.com. Now, finally, here is the judgment and sentence of the court. 1. After a thorough examination of the evidence, the magistrates of the court have come to a unanimous verdict. The court finds all 13 of the primary defendants guilty as charged of complicity in crimes against humanity, murder, and participating in the trafficking and ritual rape, torture, and murder of children. 2. By a majority opinion, the court sentences all the defendants in absentia to imprisonment for life, without the possibility of parole, and the forfeiture of their assets and authority. In a dissenting opinion, two of the court magistrates state that the death penalty is required in the sentencing of those defendants who bear command responsibility for Ninth Circle atrocities and who have personally participated in those rituals. Now, these defendants who the two judges recommended to receive the death penalty are Robert Prevost, a.k.a. Pope Leo XIV, Justin Welby, former Archbishop of Canterbury, and the three Catholic cardinals Pietro Parolin, Timothy Dolan, and Reinhard Marx. Point 3. As part of the sentence and under law, the following government officials are hereby stripped of their authority and public office and must be removed from any position of authority, and the citizens, police, and public officials of their countries are absolved of all allegiance and duty towards them and must aid in their arrest and imprisonment. And these three individuals are Donald Trump, President of the United States, Charles Windsor, so-called King Charles III of Great Britain, and Mark Rutte, Secretary General of NATO. And finally, the enforcement order. 1. The court hereby orders the immediate arrest and incarceration of all the defendants according to the terms of this verdict and sentence. 2. To this effect, the court hereby issues the following universal arrest and reclamation warrant, which will be attached to the posting at murderbydecree.com. This warrant empowers court sheriffs and any person, group of persons, or police officer to detain and incarcerate any and all of the sentenced defendants of the guilty, and to seize the assets of these people and those associated with their respective bodies corporate as convicted criminal organizations. 3. Under international law, the criminal conviction of the forenamed heads of state and church renders those powers null and void, and thereby makes the Church of Rome and the Vatican, the United States of America, and the Crown of England in Great Britain rogue regimes. Accordingly, the nations of the world are compelled by international law and are required to assist in the enforcement of this court order. They must bring to justice these convicted persons and aid in the disestablishment of their criminal regimes. Now, what follows is a lawful judgment and sentence of the International Court of Justice, because it has the authority of international law and it has universal jurisdiction and application. The evidence and judgments described here stand as uncontested fact under the law. This is registered in the International Common Law Court of Justice on Monday, October 6, 2025, by Secretary George Dufour as case docket number 08092025A001. See murderbydecree.com under ITCS Updates and Archives, and the court secretariat can be contacted at itccsoffice@protonmail.com. And finally, besides the copy of the Universal Arrest and Reclamation Warrant, there are two affirmations of this court judgment. First, from the Chilcotin Indigenous Nation and its Chief Justice, Suzanne Holland, who affirms this court ruling and pledges to help enforce it on the territory in Western, what is called Canada, their Chilcotin territory, through their court, the Universal Supreme Court of the Chilcotin Nation. And secondly, the Congress of the Sovereign Republic of Canada has issued a proclamation and an act today that has been validated by the Supreme Court of the Republic. That act enables the judgment of the International Common Law Court, which you've heard today, to be applied anywhere within the former territory of Canada. This act was debated and passed within the Assemblies and Congress of the Republic, and it's ratified by the Supreme Court. It recognizes and applies the verdict and sentence to anywhere in Canada, in the Republic of Canada, and enables its provisions to be enforced anywhere within that nation and within its affiliated traditional Indigenous nations. By this act, all Republic of Canada citizens, as well as anyone who inhabits the nation of Canada, so-called former Dominion of Canada, including all police officers, are compelled to enforce the said verdict and sentence against these convicted felons named in the judgment using the attached warrant. This act, along with the ICLCJ verdict, affirms the Republic's constitutional banishment, reclamation, and expropriation of the criminally convicted Roman Catholic, Anglican, and United Church of Canada. All clergy and officials of these criminal churches are subject to immediate arrest. The Central Sheriff's Office of the Republic of Canada, along with local Republic militias, will head this enforcement and reclamation within our borders. This act is registered and made law today, the fifth day of October in the year 2025, by the authority of the Supreme Court of the Republic of Canada and according to the will of the people in Congress. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Stand by for more.
Good evening. I'm Kevin Annett, and tonight I'm going to give you a lecture that I was to present to the Oxford Union, which is the oldest debating society in the world. In April 2016, I was invited to come there in Oxford University in England, and debate a cleric of the Catholic Church over the issue. Funnily enough, the topic was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, as so often happens on these occasions, the invitation to me was unexplainably withdrawn about 2 weeks before the event, and the debate between me and him never happened. So I thought it would be good to post online for the world to see exactly what I was going to say that night. Good evening. Let me begin by saying what a pleasant surprise it is to be able to join you all here tonight. The last time I tried to give a public talk in England, at a London rally to protest child trafficking by church and state, your privately run UK border agency saw fit to arrest, fingerprint, jail me, and then finally deport me from your country without giving a reason at all. So be that as it may, and it usually is, I especially want to thank you for having me here tonight, having the courage to have me here tonight. Tonight's topic for debate is framed rather tellingly. Is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And assumably by that is meant its holding company, the Vatican Incorporated. Well, the very wording of the subject's interesting because it implies that no, there isn't any good at all. Let's search for some. Of course, trying to locate integrity in a corporation is like looking for love in a brothel. So perhaps the question of tonight's debate's already been answered. My job's done, we can all go home. In any event, the title of the main event tonight is a bit confusing, beginning with the term good, which is, after all, a completely relative and morally ambiguous term. the Spanish conquistadors and their slaughter-blessing Catholic priests thought that they were doing good when they wiped out millions of non-Catholic people for their own good. The Vatican's Inquisition that barbecued and tortured to death Christians who disagreed with Rome was officially entitled an auto da fe, which means act of faith. Even the present so-called liberal Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, speaks of the goodness and zeal of the Franciscan missionaries who worked to death thousands of Aboriginal men, women, and children on Catholic slave plantations in California. Well, some things never change. Bergoglio also recently pardoned some 10,000 of his own child-raping priests, no doubt in the same spirit of doing good, at least good for his own institution. Human beings, especially when goaded on and justified by religion, always adorn their crimes in a halo of goodness. I've had personal experience of what I speak about. For over 20 years in Canada, I've lived and worked and documented alongside these folks who have lived through the story, the reality of genocide in Canada, perpetrated mostly by Catholic-run Indian residential schools, where over 60,000 children died. Half of these children never came back because at the hands of the priests and nuns, they were ritually tortured, routinely starved, trafficked, experimented upon, flogged, gang-raped, and killed en masse with smallpox and tuberculosis. Not one Catholic priest has ever gone to trial for any of these crimes, nor will they. These killers are above the law as it stands now. And having had the misfortune of speaking with enough of these scum, I know that these complicit clergy are still convinced that they were only trying to do good to the little brown savages by killing their bodies to save their souls, to quote their buddy Thomas Aquinas, one of the founding theologians of the Catholic Church. So perhaps what we need to do is redefine the term good in a better way, using this simple definition. To do good means to do no harm to others and to let them be themselves. Of course, under that definition, you immediately disqualify and condemn the Roman Catholic Church, which has killed more people than any institution in human history. The Church of Rome's body count is well over 50 million corpses, ever since it was made a legal corporation by the Emperor Constantine in the year 317. All right, that may all be true, sputter the defenders of Rome. So nobody's perfect. But look at all the charitable works the Church does all the time. Isn't that good? Well, in that sense, perhaps tonight's topic for debate should have been entitled instead, Was There Any Good in Pablo Escobar, the head of the criminal syndicate known as the Medellin Drug Cartel? Because Pablo engaged in lots of charitable good works for the poor folks of Colombia. Just like the Roman Catholic Church, of which he was a dues-paying member, Pablo used his ill-gotten loot to build shelters for the homeless, playgrounds for some slum kids, and soup kitchens for the hungry. Of course, that charitable money was covered in blood and paid for by the early deaths from drug addiction of the very same people he was helping, but still, he was doing some good, wasn't he? Now, my analogy between Pablo Escobar and the Vatican is more than fitting, since not only are they members of the same club, but also the Vatican Bank is heavily invested in the international drug cartels, as well as the arms and human trafficking industries that go along with it. GMO companies, Big Pharma, the biggest small arms company in the world, Beretta Limited, even dozens of online internet porn companies, all of these 100% Vatican investments pay for the goodies doled out to those deserving poor people who kiss the claw that feeds them. But let's take on directly the suggestion that the Roman Catholic Church, as the world's richest and least accountable corporation, plays a major role in providing charitable sustenance to the world's needy. Let's ask, what percentage of the Church's annual revenue actually goes towards charitable works? Well, it's an important question, not only for the debate tonight, but because the only legal basis for the Church to be exempt from paying taxes under the Law of Nations is that they must devote all, not some, but all, of their collected revenue for either the advancement of religion or charitable works. Well, right there, you can knock out the Roman Catholic Church unless someone wants to explain what money laundering for the mafia, buying cruise missiles for third world dictators, or issuing routine bribes to politicians and governments all over the world have to do with either religion or charity. What percentage of the Catholic Church's revenue goes towards charity? Actually, less than 1%, at least in America. For tellingly, that's the only country in the world where the Church consistently publishes any of its financial records, After all, the Vatican is a closed, self-governing, totally unaccountable body, like any secret criminal society. But that inconvenient, lingering notion of a separation of church and state found in the American Constitution requires that even the Catholic Church has to create an appearance of transparency. And so according to the U.S. government, in the year 2013, the Roman Catholic Church in America had a net revenue of $13.4 billion. And that's just in one country, where only about 15% of the world's Catholics live. By projection, the annual income of the Vatican must be in the hundreds of billions of dollars, not just from all those collection plates from those saps, but also from its massive global investment portfolio and its secret financial concordat agreements with over 100 governments that channel a regular percentage of your tax money into the Vatican Bank and all of its criminal behavior. But coming back to America, the one country where a light is shone on the murky underworld of Vatican finances, according to the same self-audit of the Catholic Church, of the $13.4 billion raked in during 2013, only 1.1% of it went to charity. But since half of that amount came from government grants to Catholic aid societies, in reality, a whopping 0.6% of the income went from the bank accounts into charities. But since those charities are mostly owned and operated by the church itself, it just means that one hand of the octopus is feeding the other. Quite brilliant, don't you think? One half of 1%, friends. The truth is that the Roman Catholic Church is not a force for charitable works. Just look at the books. It's in fact a huge criminal racket, a money-sucking corporation that kept afloat by every taxpayer in the world. Okay, so let's turn to the other basis for the church not paying a dime of taxes, the advancement of religion. What percentage of its time and money goes towards advancing its particular, and I might say extremely violent, religious creed? Less than 10%. That's the time each week a priest spends conducting prayers, masses, or catechism classes, according to the church itself, according to a statement from the Vatican's Governing College of Cardinals, who in 2014 issued an internal report concerning the training and ordination of its priests. The main job of the clergy, according to the cardinals, is the material and social upkeep of the church, guarding the building, the safeguard of its traditions and operations, and the expansion of its income and membership. Like in any big corporation, somebody somewhere tell me where God, let alone Jesus Christ, enters into that whole mess. Okay, strike two. In case you didn't know, that's a baseball term. I don't play cricket. The third and final strike against the Roman Catholic Church, and you got to watch out that for that term because the word Catholic means universal, which it is not. The final strike against the Catholic Church lies in its real and not imagined nature. Once its enormous pretense and lie is pulled back and we see it for what it is historically and today. But to do so and to pierce the mental fog surrounding the Vatican Incorporated, we have to realize that the papacy is not a Christian church at all. On the contrary, it is in every respect a cult of emperor worship derived from late 3rd century Rome, not from the historic Jesus, not even from the early Christian church. This fact is crucial if we're to deal with the mental confusion of many people, atheists included, who ponder helplessly, but how can a body that preaches about the love of Jesus cause mass murder, genocide, and institutionalized child rape? Of course, the simple answer to that is that it's always the worst child rapist in town who has the most sterling reputation. The latter is needed as a cloak by any crook. The bigger the felony, the sweeter the coating. Talk, my friends, is easy, especially from a pulpit. But let's not forget what Jesus himself warned, quote, many false prophets will come in my name and say, I am the Christ. But do not be fooled, by their works you shall know them. Bingo, by their works you shall know them. Well, we can see the works of the papacy all too well. Conquest, brutality, just wars, genocide, inquisition, and the crushing of the human spirit. And it all began when the Roman emperors Aurelian and Constantine created the Roman Catholic Church on the murdered bones of the early Christian church. The church was an extension and continuation of that other big killing machine called the Roman Empire. Proof of this, you don't have to look any further than the Pope's official title, which is Pontifex Maximus, which in Latin means the great bridge between, guess where, heaven and earth. That was the Latin title of the emperors of Rome, starting with Aurelian in the year 275, who also assumed the title Deus et Dominus, means God and Master. One man who's become God. Well, first that was the emperor, but now today to a Catholic, it's the Pope. Christ is no longer the link to God, but a man is, elected and elevated blasphemously over humanity, even over God, by other old men in funny hats. Well, not surprisingly, every newly elected pope is also given the title Vicari Christi, which is even more blatant. In Latin, it means the replacement of Christ, the one who replaces Christ. In black and white, it's right there. Catholicism, papism, is the replacement of Christianity. An empire of conquest and wealth relying on the means of the world and not the way of Christ. Just look at the body count. And listen to these admissions of guilt right from the horse's mouth, or I should say ass. Statements from various popes down the centuries that have never been contradicted or repudiated by any of their successors. Pope Boniface in 1302. We declare it is necessary for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff. Pope Leo in 1520. The Pope is Christ himself on earth. Pope Pius in 1929. Fascism is simply the doctrines of our faith made the law in government. Pope John in 1962. No man may enter into Christ unless he be led there by the sovereign pontiff. Pope John Paul in 1996. Have no fear when men call me Christ on earth, for I am he. Pope Benedict in 2008. You need not go to Christ for salvation. Come to me. Pope Francis in 2016. Christ made himself sin, made himself the devil. That's new. For our salvation. Only the church and its magisterium can claim holy infallibility. Have you had enough? I know I have. Well, is it any wonder that such a power-obsessed, megalomaniac religion makes itself unaccountable, sees nothing with its crimes, and uses the image and words of Christ himself to delude and soak its millions of dupe followers to believe that a bit of a communion wafer or a papal blessing or the right amount of cash delivered into church coffers will buy their way into heaven, as if one can? Well, unfortunately, I saw it for myself when I was last in Rome in 2011. Right there in the Vatican Museum, a display board for buying indulgences just like out of Martin Luther's day. Special papal blessings cost you only 150 euros. The more you spend, the closer you get to heaven. Although be warned, apparently, according to the sign, apparently God prefers credit cards to cash. How right when Pope Leo in 1520 said, "This myth of Christ has served us well." Well, the most dangerous group in the world is a super wealthy cult that sees itself as God, superior to everyone, and therefore justified in doing whatever is needed to protect itself and rule the world. A cult, in other words, like the Church of Rome. What other being than a cult can operate according to a criminal policy like Crimen Solicitanus, which has been binding on all Catholics since the year 1929? That policy states that whenever a child is raped or otherwise harmed by a priest, the police are not to be told, the victim is to be silenced, and if anyone speaks of this, they are excommunicated, thrown into hell for snitching on a rapist. Clearly, the God of Rome, like the Mafia, cannot tolerate a snitch. Better instead to operate under a global criminal conspiracy to aid and abet child rapists and killers than to cost the church a lawsuit or save a child's life. Heaven forbid. And yet, despite all of this criminal arrangement, the world keeps wondering why there's so much child rape within the Church of Rome. Are we all that blind? Do we really think a lion isn't going to eat a gazelle? Well, John Acton, a British politician, said, "Absolute power corrupts absolutely." He was referring to the Church of Rome when he made that statement, something conveniently left out of the history books. The Church of Rome is absolutely corrupt, but it also corrupts whoever is near to it, like all who attend it, who fund it, who associate with it, or rent its halls, or smile on its policies, or look the other way at all its public relations gestures. All who do so partake in that corruption. And under the law of God and mankind, those human accessories are equally guilty of all its crimes. The only good that can be said to come out of this most violent, corrupt, and anti-Christ body in history is how its evil awakens people to the need for a return to the simple words, witness, and spirit of Jesus himself, a spirit that has always been the chief adversary of the Church of Rome. Jesus founded a community of called out people, a remnant not of this world, a congregation, not a church. Nowhere did Jesus speak of popes, of bishops, of rituals and ceremonies by which someone would mediate him and God to others. He said that the kingdom of heaven lay inside each of us, not outside in a communion wafer or a religious ritual. That inner kingdom of Christ alone is the guide of all true Christians, who must come out from and be separate from all these vile, false and violent churches that deny God in practice and kill children in practice. And that's the task of any deluded soul still caught in the fatal grip of Rome and its blasphemous illusions and depravities. As America's founding fathers said, we hold this truth to be self-evident. And one of those men, the second U.S. president, John Adams, said, quote, "A free government and the Roman Catholic religion can never exist together in any nation or country. Liberty and popery are opposed," unquote. The nature of an ancient corporate evil like the Church of Rome does not change over time. It simply alters its appearance because it comes out of the dark ruler of this world, the one whom Jesus said, "He is a lie from the beginning, for he is the father of lies," Satan. It's a good thing to free ourselves from a lie as huge as Roman Catholicism and as criminal. As freeborn men and women, we are made for the truth, and when we recognize it, our hearts and our minds breathe freely and we return to our natural sense of liberty and independence. From that place of freedom, we are empowered to take action to stop criminals in every high place, whether they be popes or presidents or prime ministers. For we, the people, are the source of all sovereignty, of government, of law, and of religion. We can and must stop and arrest and confine child-raping priests when the police and courts refuse to do so. We can and must shut down the churches that traffic children and have hidden their crimes over centuries, like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church of England, the United Church of Canada, all of these criminal bodies. For the life of one child is more sacred than all the fanfare and rituals of any church anywhere. Well, Jesus had his own prescription for child killers. He said, "Whoever would harm one of these innocent ones should have a millstone placed around his neck and be thrown into the sea." Well, I wonder what Jesus would say about an entire institution that mocks God, murders with impunity, rapes and murders children, and protects those who do so. Is there a millstone that is big enough to sink such an institution? Yes, there is. It is we, the people. I thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. Kevin Anna, Eagle Strong Voice again. How do we actually fight a bigger adversary? That was the question really behind the book, The Art of War, which was written 3,000 years ago by the Chinese general Sun Tzu. He's a good guide for lots of combat, including spiritual, political, personal. But in order to define how we are successful against these big institutions of church, state, and corporatocracy, we have to understand more the nature and purpose of our struggle. Quoting Sun Tzu, "Whoever grasps and holds on to the essential energy or chi of a situation will control the outcome of any battle and the fate of any opponent, no matter how powerful they are." So we're going to look at this thing, chi, today. Our struggle to create the Republic of Canada and real self-governance is part of a whole global movement to defend humanity from a corporate tyranny that's declared war on our planet and its people. We see the devastating effect of that war, from our western tar sands to offshore oil spills to the toxic poisoning of our land and our air. Imagine for a minute that tyranny is not simply the visible system of corporatocracy, violence, and corruption, but more deeply, it is really a vast system of energy transfer, sucking the vitality and life from billions of people and the biosphere itself into a massive machine. Call that machine whatever you like. Its nature and behavior is geared toward a single purpose, and that is the absorption of all life into itself. It is one enormous feeder, and we are its morsels. Well, to understand the simple truth equips us inwardly to stop this insatiable machine and our participation in it far better than simple political analysis can. But understanding alone doesn't free us to act. All interactions in our universe involve an essential energy that guides the movement of every particle and determines every outcome. Sun Tzu called this energy qi. Plato saw it as a pre-existing essence behind the mask of appearances. Some like to call it God. But regardless of the name, the source that binds our reality is like a mighty river
that can either sweep us along helplessly or be utilized by us to alter reality. Every ruler understands this simple fact, even while the rest of us have been trained not to understand it. And thereby, we're kept eyeless and blind in a harness held by a few. Those who understand and utilize qi are able to control the thoughts and actions of the multitudes of humanity only as long as the people are devoid of their own access to qi. While the primary way of stripping humanity of attaining its normal, inherent qi power is by using fear and trauma-based conditioning at a very young age to cause people to habitually surrender and defer to every level of external authority automatically, without thinking. And by deferring in that way to some other power, they thereby transfer their own particle of qi to that power. Such an unending energy transfer from the many to the few is the basis of all elite rule in our world, and of all the problems in our world. Despite its hegemony, such a system is inherently unstable. Because following natural law, the nature of qi, as with any energy system, is to disseminate equally and be held in common by all, and not privately. And this fact invalidates, as contrary to the natural order, all individual rule, whether it's by kings, presidents, popes, or corporate oligarchies. We know from our own experience that the loss of qi from the many to the few is not simply unnatural. It is constant and systemic, so much so that it cannot be resisted by individual effort alone, because our individuality is being conditioned to operate habitually rather than consciously. We think like we eat automatically, and therefore without qi. For instance, when faced with political repression by those who hold qi, by the official rulers, our first reflex is to surrender our qi to them once again by pressuring them to give us justice through ritualized protest and petitioning, or relying on their courts and voting. In truth, we find it hard to shift our attention away from the rulers because we have no working experience of what our own qi actually is. We therefore cannot try to change our world without continually deferring to the powers that be, whether that be a sympathetic judge, or a progressive politician, or a spiritual advisor. Well, quite simply, our imprinted slave thinking makes it seemingly impossible for us to collectively reclaim ourselves in our world. Erasing a conditioned imprint may begin within the individual, but it is not manifested individualistically, because collectivity is the nature of the universe and of qi, which binds all phenomena in a mutual garment of destiny and interconnectedness. In any successful revolution, the personal awakening of individuals causes a ripple effect in many other hearts and minds that generates a new kind of group qi, one that is unalterably opposed to the qi of the rulers. This group qi is a working counterculture that draws energy and power away from the rulers in their system and returns it to the people, provided the people can hold on to it by retaining their own separate collective identity. That's precisely why the Republic of Canada has to be based on direct local self-governance of the people through their own Republican assemblies, because by doing that, by forming those assemblies, they are actively withdrawing their qi and power from the system called corporate Canada and causing that corporatocracy to collapse from within. The very nature and purpose of our struggle today is to achieve precisely that new energy dynamic and allow all our people to reclaim their natural qi and the collective liberty that it bestows. This purpose must continually guide our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. Well, how do we apply qi knowledge to our present situation? Chinese General Sun Tzu, writing 3,000 years ago, had the best understanding of how such an awareness of the qi energy behind reality can be used in battles of war and politics. He writes, "Nothing is permanent in life except conflict and change. One either masters the qi of one's opponent, or one is mastered by it." Well, let's set aside our Western philosophical bias for a minute that separates matter from spirit. We recognize that Sun Tzu is accurately describing the dance that occurs in any conflict with an adversary. He says, "Enemies, like all opposites, are mutually dependent on one another, being part of a greater unity and purpose. So enemies are defeated not by their abolition, but by their absorption into a new and greater whole. In short, we can win any engagement not by outnumbering or crushing an opponent, but by redirecting their own essential energy into the outcome we desire. In other words, we don't ask anyone for freedom or change. We create that change ourselves. A classic example of the power of such an approach is found in Canada during the years 2005 to 2008. During part of the campaign that I helped to launch to indict church and state for genocide, that campaign consisted at best of maybe a couple of dozen people in three cities, in Vancouver, Winnipeg, and Toronto. But we successfully forced Canada and its churches to respond to our actions by admitting their crime. And they therefore set up their own ultimate disillusion, because by acceding to a new reality, the old matrix called Christian Canada was forced to surrender to our much smaller numbers its own chi. And it helped to tremendously energize the movement towards the republic that will disestablish crown and church. This new power alignment is crumbling Canada and laying the basis for a new chi arrangement, that is our Republic of Canada. Now, how do we achieve that victory? It wasn't by numbers, but it was by our strategic position, by our constant and visible persistence, and our ability as a small guerrilla force to continually outmaneuver and redirect the chi of the system. Armed as that force was, by the undeniable truth and evidence that we had that both church and state were guilty of mass murder and, as a result, because they knew that, constantly kept them on the defensive and in a state of fear. Well, building on that success in Canada, where we got Canada and its churches to admit something they didn't ever want to admit, similarly, but even more stunning, is the other greater victory that flowed from this first one, namely the blow against the Vatican and Rome, and how we did. It deposed Pope Benedict on February 23, 2013 by using the same methods, by publicly convicting him and other top church officials for the same genocide. This successful mastering by a few of a huge, powerful opponent's chi happened because that small movement that we were a part of deliberately used a strategy of guerrilla warfare, of unpredictability and mobility, which is summed up by Sun Tzu in this way. Quote, first, when I am few, and my enemy is many, I can use the few to strike the many, because those whom I battle are restricted, being larger and more unwieldy. Their strength thereby becomes their weakness, as it proved in Rome and Ottawa. Second, do not respond to the ground your enemy has prepared for you, but instead shape their ground. Then they have no alternative but to be led by you, as if it was their own idea. And that's crucial. You never, ever act on the ground of the enemy. You don't respond to the issues they raise. You don't say, yes, this is about a coronavirus these days. You say, no, it's about a police state. Just like we said, no, this is not about individual sexual abuse of children. It's about genocide. And now even the prime minister is using the word. That's what Sun Tzu is talking about. You define the ground and the language and the narrative, and they have to respond to you no matter how small you are. And thirdly, hide the time of battle from an enemy and make what he loves and defends your first target by aiming at and seizing what the enemy holds dear. Their greater strength and plans are rendered useless, and they must stop and respond to you on your terms, no matter how small are your forces. Well, as an example of that, on March 17, 2008, during Sunday services, two of our action groups occupied without warning the largest Catholic cathedrals in Vancouver and Toronto. And we made headlines across Canada with the demand that the Catholic, Anglican, and United churches be forced to return the remains of the children they had killed over 100 years. Our groups announced that we'd be launching an international court action charging Canada with genocide. Well, guess what? Less than 2 weeks later, the Harper government in Ottawa announced for the first time an inquiry into the missing residential school children, which led directly to the so-called apology in Parliament 3 months later in July 2008. And the eventual admission by Ottawa that they committed genocide. Well, by striking unexpectedly at the Achilles heel of the main instigator of genocide, those churches, behind their lines during the most sacred ritual, our guerrilla movement not only shocked and frightened the enemy, but we created the field of battle and we forced our opponent, in their fear, to respond on our terms. Since then, no one in Canada has dared anymore to deny that children were killed in residential schools or that it was genocide. In other words, we very few people reshape the national narrative, or in Sun Tzu words, we mastered the chi of an enormous adversary and redirected it on our terms. And similarly, the shockwave that deposed Pope Benedict has continued to spread, forcing further resignations by top Vatican officers and compelling an enormous and desperate public relations effort by the present Pope Francis to shore up Rome's collapsing credibility. Well, what is all of this but living proof of the ability of a small force to absorb the chi of the biggest and oldest enemy imaginable, the Vatican Incorporated? We'll compare these stunning victories by a handful of people with the negligible results of many thousands of protesters standing outside government buildings and waving placards, and thereby surrendering their collective chi to their adversary, handing it over once more. For the unstated message of any group of protesters to some external power is this: we acknowledge your authority. You have the power, not us. All we ask is that you change things for us. Well, this is not change on the terms of the people. It's accommodation to elite rule, regardless of the outcome, because what the elites give, they can take away tomorrow. This impotence called protest, like voting or going through the courts, is in truth the clearest example of the energy-sucking nature of the machine that relies on such controlled opposition to feed its own chi. In reality, no such diminishing of people's own chi is ever necessary, for the ability of any size group to capture the chi of the government and any corporate regime has already been proven by us in practice. In energetic terms, this constitutes a reclaiming of power in order to rebalance chi, whose nature is to disseminate and be shared equally. This approach is the only sure means of changing the nature of power and thereby bringing down tyranny forever. And yet, as we noted, understanding this truth does not automatically make it happen, for the simple fact that we are a very part of what it is we oppose. It's often remarked, usually as a justification for not getting involved in a radical movement, that all revolutions just end up replacing one tyrant with another. And from a distance, history seems to bear this out. The moments where masses of people shake off their chains and govern themselves directly seems to be brief and episodic. Most of the time, the masses appear to be like a passive herd led around by some elite or another. But this appearance is in fact illusory, because just because people acquiesce to a regime doesn't mean that they're actively supporting it. They just don't see any alternative. People will act to change things only when they can see and feel that there exists a working alternative to the status quo, only when they're able to recognize and establish that new collective chi, like a local Republican People's Assembly. But why doesn't that happen very often? What is the bulwark that holds people back? Well, you can only answer this by knowing, first of all, that chi is symbiotic. It's interdependent. Just as darkness and light depend on one another and are aspects of the same phenomena, so too are opponents in any war or any political change. Even the biblical war in heaven was fought between two types of angels, Lucifer, in fact, meaning a being of light. Any struggle is ultimately a dance between the same entity wearing different masks. Just as chi, like water, always seeks the lowest and most common ground, so does any conflict. Whether consciously or not, both sides search for a new symbiosis by which they can survive and prosper in a new definition. For this reason, it's impossible for any group of citizens to establish a new society within the thinking and the institutions of the old regime, since all of our thoughts and hopes are conditioned by it. Friedrich Engels observed that, following the aborted European insurrections of 1848, men always begin and end revolutions with their eyes fixed on the past. Well, if you fix your eyes on the past and don't look to your own chi, you're naturally going to replicate the existing system. Now, over the years, we've continually experienced people looking to the past constantly when we work with Canadians about the Republic. While holding to the vision of a new Republic based on common law, our best people still insist on going into the lawless Crown courts to remedy the latest injustice done against them. They simply can't turn away from the old regime. They're dependent on it psychologically. What they're really dependent on is what's sometimes called a group mind. The Bible calls it our angel, which is really a collective totality that governs our thinking. The only remedy for overcoming that group mind is a mind of our own. And we're going to go into that in more detail in future broadcasts. Because it's only by establishing that new collectivity, a new way of thinking outside the old box, that we can bring in a new society in a real way, not just talking, but creating it on the ground. We're going to go into more of that in detail. Stay tuned for more and stand by.